and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature Interviews. Today I have a fabulous, I think it's a documentary, but we're going to get into it. It's more like a life story, but I have directors here, we'll get into it. I have David Tuck, a story of a Holocaust survivor. I have a lovely director, Jill Freshy, here. Thank you. Welcome to the show. And her partner might show up, might not. We'll find out.
Thank you for having me.
So
happy to be here.
Oh, look, hang on. I think he is here. Hold on. As we're waiting here, people, this is vastly exciting radio here. Hey, welcome. I just introduced your fabulous director co-host, and now I'm joined by John Ricucci. How are you?
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm excellent. So I haven't even asked the first question yet, so you've missed nothing. So you're right up to date. So let's start at the beginning. When I was watching this, things were coming into my head, like, how did you meet this person?
You mean the Holocaust survivor?
Correct.
We met him through someone whose father was a B-17 bomber pilot in World War II. And she asked Jill and I, would we like to be a Holocaust survivor? And I said yes. She gave us his contact information, which led us to the Holocaust Awareness Museum Educational Center in Philadelphia, which is affiliated with the synagogue. So from there, Jill and I progressed to complete our relationship with this very unique, unusual, and extraordinary man.
So, Jill, when you guys go and you get your subject, who approaches them first, or do you guys approach as a unit?
Well, with David, John made the initial contact, and usually we talk to the person that we're going to interview or do a documentary on, but we don't like to really delve too much into the story because the telling of the story the first time is always the most emotional and the most heartfelt. So, you know, we won't really talk about their life. We won't know what they're going to say. And we'll basically just make the initial contact, set up a date and time, and just start asking questions. And, you know, we really didn't know anything about David until he said, let me tell you my life story. And we were just blown away by his life story.
Yeah. Let me say this to you, that as a very young child, I'm going back and I rattled my mind after I met David. 10 years old, my mother used to subscribe to Life magazine. And I remember her getting these big magazines when these Holocaust pictures first came out, probably in 1958, 1959, somewhere like that. And I was fascinated as to how this happened. And then to meet someone who actually lived that experience was so extraordinary and moving to me. I can't begin to tell you. It supersedes all boundaries of my imagination to know someone at 12 years old who survived first the separation line by lying, saying he was 15 and not 12, because 14 was the limit where they separated people. And to actually, without family or friends, live that experience, I cannot tell you how that affects your life. I just need to say that.
Okay, I just want to back. How do you guys split up your directing duties? Because, I mean, in this one, John, you're interviewing, obviously. And Jill, are you behind the camera?
Yes. I do all the technical production, post-production, setting up. Basically, I'm a one-man band. I'll set up the cameras, the lighting, the audio, you know, check the audio levels and, you know, make sure there's no microphones in the picture and the, you know, everything looks great. And then John is really the historian, so he brings all the questions and the history and what he wants to get out of the interview. And he does the interviewing, and then I do the editing, and we produce the show. And then we both do the marketing.
So, John, did you find David was resistant to the interview at any time? Did you have to coax him into things, or he just opened up immediately?
John?
No, I'm sorry. He was very open to discussion. One of the things that I found very, very interesting as the closet historian that I am, is that I found he had an encounter with Heinrich Himmler while he was in Auschwitz. And Himmler was the, I'm going to say founder, that's my word, of the death camps. And I found a 1939 Time magazine picture of Heinrich Himmler. And the only time that David showed any real emotion, when I say emotion, something that just stirred a feeling in him, was when I showed him the picture of Heinrich. And I said, "What do you see when you see him?" And he said, "I don't hate, but I'll never forget." And that's where we got the title of the story, that his encounter, his eye-to-eye contact with Heinrich Himmler, which to me was extraordinary. He would do that. But David was very open, and we would ask him questions prior to the interview, after the interview, during the interview. But there weren't many questions. He did all the talking, essentially. But he was very open to talking about his experience at Auschwitz and being branded, which is to see someone who's actually branded. And that's what he was. They say, "Oh, they were tattooed." No, they were branded. They weren't tattooed.
So, Jill, yeah. Bing, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, David's a pretty extraordinary man. He really made it his mission to teach young students. And I think he's taught probably about 2,000 students, I think he told me at one point. So, or more. He goes, so for the last, I don't know how many years, through this Holocaust Awareness Museum Educational Center, they go to schools and he tells them firsthand, don't hate. Hating is bad. Let me tell you what happened to me. This is, you know, stemmed from hate. So he's a pretty remarkable guy. We didn't really have to, you know, prod him too much, because this is his story and he likes to tell it, and he likes to use it to motivate young people to do the right thing.
So, Jill, being behind the camera, and I mean, you got John who knows what he's doing. Do you ever have a question that comes to your head going, "John, I need you to ask this question. This just popped in." How do you get that to him? I mean, John is focused there.
Well, John, yeah, trying to interrupt John when he's on, like, you know, a quest to get his question in, and then I want to, you know, divert him to another question. It is pretty hard, but John has, like, learned to just listen to me.
Well done.
But when we used to do it in the studio, I'd have to write it down because it was live to tape and you couldn't edit too much. So I would write it down and hold up the question. And he'd always be, like, squinting, you know, "What? What do you say?" But, yeah, I mean, I definitely do have, oftentimes after the interview, a listener, I'll say, you know, "Please talk this about this or this." Or maybe the guy will, like David talked about his father. Now, we didn't really include the whole story about his father because I wanted it to be upbeat and I didn't really want the audience to really know the backstory. But I personally wanted to know more, but we didn't really you know, include that. But that was one of the questions I asked John to ask him about.
You know, in order to, you know, to follow up on your question, in order to do what Jill and I do, you have to have an exceptional and unique simpatico to do what we do, because you add one person to this group, and everything goes crazy. It's like we have to know what the other person has to do, and it's you know, Jill used the word learn. I would say she trained me to respond to certain things. And yeah, she's right. I get onto a thing, but the relationship that we have as far as producing quality content is extraordinary, because you have to have that certain simpatico. It has to be just perfect to know what the other person wants and expects. And I know that going into it, and I know the way she thinks, and we talk about it in advance. And it worked very well with David. It worked very well in Los Angeles and in Philadelphia.
So my next question, how long have you two been working together since you've got this terrific simpatico?
Yeah, that was an argument earlier tonight. I said,
We were arguing about it for about a half hour. Eight years, yeah.
Okay. So when you come on a subject like this, I mean, this is heavy-duty topic. This is not like interviewing me and about the podcast, and you know it's going to be happy, it's going to be fun. How do you guys approach your subject matter? Do you pick a bunch of subjects, or do you just look for things that interest you?
Well, it's interesting because we get that question a lot, and I use this saying that, you know, you don't look for causes, you know, causes just sort of fall in your lap. You know, they just sort of occur, or you're like with Kensington, we did an opioid film on called Kensington in Crisis about the opioid addiction problem in Philadelphia. We just happened to be there and we looked around and we said, oh my God, we need to do a story about this. And, the next story, Life Without Parole, was about a guy who got life without parole, basically on marijuana charges. Somebody introduced us to him. So, you know, you can't really look like what to do a documentary on. It just sort of happens. Would you agree with that? Like with David, we were at Starbucks having coffee and someone came up to us and said, John, you know, you interviewed my father. He was a World War II vet. Well, there's a Holocaust survivor. How would you like interview him? So, yeah.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you. I think that our initiatives are to do things that we find educational and informative. And a lot of people come at us with, hey, you should interview this person, or you should talk about this, or you should do a story about that. And I say to myself, or to them sometimes, well, what are they going to tell me that's so unbelievable that's going to have an effect on our community and do something? And certainly David was, and some of the other things that we've done that we find incredibly unique and beneficial to a community, because that's where we really are. We really want to bring something worthwhile to the communities, to anywhere, to the country. Anybody's willing to look at what we do, it has to be beneficial. It's not there just silly entertainment.
How much research do you put into a subject before you greet them?
Well, I did a lot of research with, and so did Jill. We did a lot of research with David, because I wanted to know more about the camps than I did. I know I can name it Dachau, Treblinka, Auschwitz, Buchenwald. I know the camps, and his was a death camp, and I wanted to know as much as I could about that. I could tell you how many people were executed every day, who they were. I'm currently reading a book about the Italian Jews that were executed. So, yes, we do a lot of research. It's not, we don't do anything clibbity-gibbet. We don't just say, okay, let's set the cameras up and roll. No, Jill and I are serious about what we do, particularly Jill. Jill is a true professional. She is, without a doubt, the best woman documentarian in the main line and Philadelphia area.
So, Jill, I'm going to go a little bit more behind the scenes because I'm always interested. How do you find setup in new places? I mean, usually you're doing an interview. Do you have to set up different for each interview? I mean, obviously, depending on light and location, but do you have a general setup and you add to it, or you do a different one every time?
Well, yeah, that's a hard nut to crack because typically someone will say, let's do the interview at my house. You can come over, and you don't really want to go, you know, you're not going to have the lighting. It's going to be messy. It's going to be dirty. It's going to be, you know, not dirty, but like maybe untidy. Well, when we interviewed Dalen Leach, and he's fabulous. It was a great interview, and he's so well-spoken. But when we got to his house, it was very, like, open but dark. It was very cloud-covered that day, and there was a lot of trees around his house. And I said, we need a room that makes you look like a senator, you know? And something like sort of stately. So he said, well, let's go in the bunny room. I'm like, the bunny room? What? Look at that. Well, literally, it's where the bunnies live. And there are bunnies hopping around. And, but it was, you know, the walls were stately and everything, but it was pretty funny with, you know, filming around the bunnies on the shag carpeting. But it did have the best lighting. And yeah, that is a real challenge for me to find where, you know, John looks good and he's a big guy. We've got to have room. So there's got to be, you know, enough space, enough overhead lighting, enough backlighting, and the audio has to be good. Yeah, it's challenging. And so we've been doing the Holocaust survivors at a synagogue with a beautiful, you could see, it had a beautiful chapel that we filmed in, and that worked out really well.
So, John, here's a question for you. When you go do your interviews, do you dress differently, or are you always dressed to the nines in the suit?
No, I dress how Jill tells me to dress. What do you wear? What shoes? No, don't wear that. Wear this. So, yeah, that's and quite frankly, that's what a good interviewer should do. He should do what the director tells him. And I would dress a certain way, and Jill would say, no, don't do that, because Jill has to take into consideration the lighting, the surroundings that we were in, what the color background is in the venue. So I dress how she tells me. What works best for me at 6 feet three and 250 pounds is to wear dark. And that's generally what I do. I wear mostly dark clothes. If the guest has a jacket, I'll bring a jacket with me. If not, if they have a tie, I'll wear a tie. If not, but it's the color coordination, et cetera, is basically is what Jill tells me to wear. The success of any relationship, of like particular, like you have to have the person who's in my position has to follow what the director tells him or her to do. And Jill is the director, and she'll say, I've learned, but she taught me to follow her instructions, and that's what I do. And that works the best.
How many days did you film your interview over?
Wait, what?
The interview with David, how many days was it filmed over? It wasn't a one take. I'm sure there's an edit there a couple times.
Yeah, it was one take, but then we went to his house, so and did some B-roll. So basically, it was a one-take wonder, honestly. But, I mean, there was a lot of editing. There was probably maybe 20 hours of editing.
Wow. Because,
yeah. You know what? And maybe even more, because what I do is, you have to get pictures to match, and then you have to take out, like, he may have said or that you hear a click or something. So all that has to be taken out, but it has to be taken out and seamlessly, so nobody really knows that it was taken out. You know, you don't want to hear like a gap of a blank nothing. So the editing takes a long, long, long time.
Okay, so
export it and all that. Do you do editing?
There was music to be added to that.
Right, Dave, we want to add a little music.
Chase did a beautiful song.
Yeah, his wife. And then, you know what took the longest was the poem at the end.
Oh, the poem, the one that, I don't need to read. I had to stop it to read it. I thought it was going a little too fast for me trying to read.
Yeah. The poem with, we found a woman with a Poland who was from Poland, and then we wanted a man who was from Poland, but we couldn't find one. So he sort of faked a Polish accent. And that took a long time because they had never been on camera or spoke in a voiceover. So I kept cutting the poem down and then making it the original. So that was a lot of fun.
But that was 29 takes.
It was really funny.
29
We're at David's house. Okay, John is 6'3". Are you using a handheld or you have it steady on a tripod? Oh, how are you shooting this?
Yeah, we have three cameras with three tripods. Yeah.
So in the house you do?
Yeah, always three. You mean just for the voiceover?
No, when you go into his house, you have a shot of him in the house.
Yeah, that's just one, a handheld.
That's what I thought. Okay. Yeah. So it's a three camera setup for the interview. Then that makes sense. I get that.
Yeah.
Are you doing the remote or do you have three camera operators?
I just set them up and I just, go check on the keep. You'll see me walking back and forth and check on them, make sure that. And there are adjustments that I make oftentimes once we start rolling. It's something I didn't see, like the other day, or John will move. You set everybody up, but then when they start talking, their heads move or they jimmy around, or all of a sudden the microphone is showing. So yeah, it's a constant juggling. I watch all three cameras, basically. Yeah.
Okay, John, during your interview, you have a big stack of notes, I've noticed, in your hand.
Yeah, they're openings that if I'm given, that I will ask them questions. It's about their experience in the camp or wherever they were. And usually, one of the things that makes the success of the interview is that you have to intensely, and that's Jill as well as myself, intensely listen to what they're saying. Every word. You can't lose focus, not for a second, because they may say something that's going to direct you right to where you were going to ask a specific thing. And I try to look for areas that I find that are most compelling for them to respond to. And Jill and I go over those things all the time. Again, it's back to the simpatico. If the director's not working in simpatico with the interviewer or whomever, it's not going to work. And the success, our success is really based on that.
Now I'll throw this question out to both of you. Did anything surprise you that you hadn't heard before from this interview? Obviously, meeting the big general or whatever he is, the guy in charge of the death camps, I'm like, oh, I haven't heard that before, was the one for me. Was there something different for you two?
Well, I didn't realize how many camps there were. That came in like as I was researching the Holocaust, you know, afterwards when he started to talk about all the different camps that he had been to. And I was under the assumption that there was maybe 100, or I didn't realize there was like 44,000, and that they were going into every country. And, it, you know, you learn about the Holocaust, but then you kind of, you know, maybe you forget, or that shocked me. The enormity of the, and the numbers, that was really, really shocking to me.
What for me was, David, at 12 years old, and I think about a lot of 12-year-olds who, in the separation line, said he was 15 because he knew that was it. And when asked, what's your job? And he said, in German, because he spoke fluent German, and that had to, had a lot to do with his survival. He said he was a mechanic. And he was put in the responsibility of working on an 88-millimeter Krupps German gun, aircraft gun. And I thought to myself, what kind of precociousness did this kid have to be able to come up with all this stuff? And he said his sense of humor. And he said his savvy. Think about a 12-year-old. And they're telling you all these things. That, to me, was the most stunning thing of all for me, to listen to him.
Now, you only had music at the beginning, and the poem at the end could be classified as music, depending on how you feel. Mm-hmm. But did you try other music in this piece, or didn't fit? Because it's because the story was so much?
You know, I tried to put music throughout, but... So I added the music when he was going back to like in time, I was trying to add it like when he would go back in time, it was emotional and I could add the pictures. But it didn't seem to work like throughout the whole thing. Cause sometimes when he was talking, you just wanted to hear his words, and he does have a little bit of an accent. But I didn't want to take away from his audio. You know, I didn't want it to fight with him. And that's like sometimes can be the most challenging, trying to get you to listen to the speaker, but then have a little bit of music, but not too much music. So then I just, you know, left out the music for most of it. Because his story, you're just riveted by what he's saying with his words. Basically. But I got to say that David, you know, is just so remarkable. He's just such a kind, loving man. You know, I call him, he's excited. We'll be in a film festival, and he's just so appreciative of what he has today from what he had, where his life could have taken him. And, I've never met anybody like them, honestly.
You know, one of the things I think that I overlooked and I didn't say to you earlier is when we were talking about projects, is sometimes some of the things that Jill and I have done successfully is a result of the serendipity of the piece, and that there are certain things that just naturally flow together. Again, serendipitously, and really make it all work. And David's was one of those things, because he trusted in us. He saw how genuine we were, and we were able to just comfortably work together, where he revealed a lot of his feelings to us. Much of his purpose, when someone invites you into their home and allows you to experience their life, they trust you. And that's invaluable to Jill and I in a relationship that we have with the projects that we do. All of them. I could speak endlessly about them all, but we're talking about David here, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Earlier, you brought up the word trust. I mean, being the director and you're not interviewing the subject, do you have to build the same sense of trust as John does?
Well, I absolutely have to trust John because, you know, I know what story I want to hear or what questions I would like answered, you know, as you're filming. And you just have to trust that he's going to get out from the speaker or the interviewer, you know, that information, you know, the who, what, where, why, and when for every story. So he, and he's a very good interviewer, so it all works out really well.
I guess
we don't do live, so we can always edit and do another question or post questions and things like that.
Before I go any further, I forgot to ask, what brings you to documentary film as opposed to fiction or not film?
What, you didn't see my cat from hell?
No.
my film tryout for a scary movie in film class. They're really hard. I think documentaries, well, first of all, I'm very curious, and documentaries, you know, are answering a question, you know, why did this happen? Why did you go to prison for life? Is there an opioid crisis in Kensington? You know, why was the Holocaust there, you know? And so, you know, you're learning something. And I'm a teacher. I teach at Montgomery County Community College. I share my videos with my students. So I guess in the back of my mind, I'm always really wanting to teach a lesson. And, you know, that I think you can do that in a documentary film. You can do that with fiction also, but I think that'd be really, really hard. You have to hire actors and actresses, and it's very costly as well.
Okay, last question before we get to fun questions. The old footage, I mean, some of it obviously came from David, the family photos and stuff, but how much more material did you feel you had to add to the film that you didn't have?
Yeah, that's the hardest part was trying to know what to put with the poem. Because I didn't want to really put faces, so I tried a lot of different things. And then I ended up with the monuments to the Holocaust victims from different countries. And that seemed to work. And then I also wanted to put the words in the background as they were reading the poem. So, you know, it's just trial and error. You don't want to put too many pictures, but you don't want to put too few. He brought a bunch with him because he had a PowerPoint presentation that he did at the elementary schools, and that was very helpful. And then when he got emotional, I tried to add, you know, pictures. Look, pictures tell us 1,000, you know, what do they say? One picture speaks 1,000 words.
Correct.
So, yeah. My teacher in film school, Alan Shear, would always say, I don't want to see a talking head. So, you know, you want to get a wide shot and you want to see something close up and far away. And you just kind of want to mix up so people don't get bored.
Okay. This has been a very serious topic. So I have just a few fun questions for Ada. We could just send you off for the night. First question everybody gets asked on the show, your favorite film?
I think it's called Tears of Endearment. Is that
yes,
the right?
Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah. Shirley MacLaine.
That is correct.
Love that.
I've only ever once saw it. Now, somebody will have to correct me if I'm ever wrong. I saw E.T. and Terms of Endearment on double bill at the drive-in when I was a kid. And I've never, don't think I ever saw the end of Terms of Endearment, but I'm pretty sure I saw some most of it.
The ending is the heart. Is that, yeah, that's crazy. Yeah.
Being a director, who is your favorite director that you have to watch every film of?
What are those brothers? What are they called? The ones
the Coen brothers?
Yes. They're hysterical. They set up as an angle or a shot. I mean, they're just geniuses. They're just unbelievable. You know, you could only aspire to do something like that. I just find their directing really well. I mean, there's a lot of great directors out there. As far as technical, you know, stuff, I like them.
Last question. Since being a teacher, and you, I presume you teach film of some kind.
I teach computer software, but go ahead.
Oh, this is going to be good. So if you were then a film teacher or a director of some kind teaching them, what's the one advice would you give to all your students?
You know, sometimes I think like, oh, should I teach film? Because I think to me, the most important thing is the beginning, the middle, and the end. And you have to have a story arc. And a good film, if it's a fiction about a character like a David, or David's a documentary, but if it's a drama or fiction, the character has to change. You know, you have to have a metamorphosis of their personality. How often do we see a movie and it's like, oh, that's the same person throughout the whole film? Nothing has changed. They didn't learn anything. So, you know, there's no empathy for that person. There's no acknowledgement or feeling of self-satisfaction at the end. So I think that, you know, even documentaries can be flat. They're just flat the whole time, you know. So I think that, and I hope we did this with David Tuck, Never Forget, is that I hope that, you know, the viewer sees a beginning, struggle. I mean, a beginning, a childhood, a free childhood, a middle where he was struggling and was about to die and could have died at any moment, how he survived, I don't know how. And then at the end, you know, he found revelation, he found forgiveness, and he was able to give back. So he was found redemption. So that those three things are important to me.
Okay, last thing before you go, tell everybody where they can find your wonderful film and the rest of your work.
So we post a lot of our short films on mainlinetv.org. You can find me on Instagram, Mainline Television. And we'll be at the First Glance Film Festival, October 15th. I'm not sure the time, but if you go to First Glance Film Festival, Philadelphia. It's in Phoenixville at the Colonial Theater. We'll be showing our film. And the way that the film festival works is there'll be two or three films all together during one time slot.
Thank you for your time, and tell John thank you and have a great evening.
Thank you, and it was great to talk with you. It was very easy, and thanks for making it fun.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.